Candlelight by Tuesday, Love Sang Grandpa. Read for you by Blue Friend in beautiful BC. Chapter 9. "Hey," screamed the words from the letter, "how is it that you, who have been doing aura work for so long, never get a good write-up in the press?" The old man thoughtfully pulled out a newspaper cutting, which was stuck in the big envelope. It was from some paper called the National Enquirer, dated September 24, 1972. It seemed that some fellow was falling over backwards and frontwards as well, to praise up the Russians and their efforts in aura research. It purports to say that plants know when the weather's going to change. Well, of course they do. I've been saying that for years. It also says the plain fact is that the Soviets are years ahead of the U.S. in research on ESP. And in the fields of mind over matter and telepathy, etc., that we may never catch up. And the astounding color movies of the human aura the Russians have made show how far they have already gone. But yet, I've been doing things like this for years. Anyway, I have had all the details about this fellow and the article before, and I wrote to him, sending him some of my books, telling him the truth as I have been informed of it. The Russians were greatly impressed with You Forever, and it sparked considerable research in Russia. The Russians have bought quite a lot of books, and they've made good use of the hints, etc., which I have given. Yes, yes, it's just fine that the Russians are making progress, but why not give a little credit here as well? It does seem to me that people go just crazy with joy and delight if the communists of Russia copy someone else and find that it works. But now that I'm a Canadian citizen, I find that a prophet is without honor in his own country. I find my books are being quoted and quoted and misquoted with never a trace of acknowledgement to me, the author. But I suppose that is the way of life. There is another book eulogizing Russian science, and the remarks above also apply to that book. I sent some details to the authors of the book, but again, they did not even have the common courtesy to reply, not even the courtesy to say thank you. I've come to the conclusion that I must be some sort of nut for answering people's letters and saying thank you if they send me a cutting or something. People have told me that, by the way, that I am a nut for bothering with so many people. Never mind, it might help someone. But I do want to put on record that the Russians do not have a monopoly on aura research. The Russians do seem to have a monopoly of finance to help research. And without money to buy equipment, well, many a promising invention has been stillborn, and that is what I am finding now. There is a telephone to heaven and a good aura camera, because the stuff the Russians are doing so far is not the true aura, but the sub-etheric auric sheath. They haven't got down to the real thing yet, but they might in time. Another letter asks, "Is it true?" that most of the great leaders of the world were tradesmen, and if so, why? Well, yes, you can say that. You can say that most of the great leaders of the world started from what are called humble origins, and there's a special reason for that. It is thought by the gardeners of the earth that those who come here to help humanity must be in touch with the majority of humans, and if a man comes as a king, then in the normal course of events he's only in contact with those of kingly or princely or ducal status. Jesus was the son of a carpenter. Possibly he took a swipe or two with carpentry tools himself. We never hear that he was a carpenter, but only the son of a carpenter. Mohammed, who was one of the great people, was an Arab tradesman, and then, at the age of 40, he began to have all sorts of messages and conversations with messengers. The content of the messenger's instructions led him to organize the Muslim religion and write the Quran. Moses, well, he was just a homeless waif who had the luck, good or bad, to be picked up by a princess. But the point is that he still was a homeless waif who had the common touch. Gautama, of course, was a prince. That is, he started off a prince, but he soon found that as a prince, he was not in touch with the common people, so he renounced his princely caste and went into the wilderness, away from his bunch of wives who made quite a commotion about being left husbandless, but in spite of great efforts to persuade him to change his mind, Gautama went into the wilderness as a poor and humble man and became the Buddha, the founder of Buddhism. He had to renounce his high estate and relinquish his wealth before he could indeed get in touch with the ordinary people who most needed help. Here's a question which I frankly do not quite understand. The question is there an absolute, possibly existing somewhere in the 7th through the 9th dimensions? Now, I do not understand that one, because what is an absolute? I wonder if the person who writes means a god, and if that is the case, well, the answer is no. Even the Manus go up much higher than the 9th dimension. The Manus that one can experience looking after this world, for example, they are the puppets of an over-self Manu. Now, here's a question for you. Are there less and less laws governing an entity the higher up on the evolutionary scale he goes? Yes, basically that is so. The laws are actually made to control the masses, and often a law which is most beneficial to a mass of people is horribly unjust to some poor, wretched individual. But laws cannot be made to suit each and every individual. A law has to be formulated so that it may embrace the great majority of people coming within its dictum. If you had read the 1972 tax forms, you would know what I mean. The instructions about this wretched form are so abstruse that I honestly can't make any sense out of it at all. And imagine that there are many more like me. But back to our question. The higher a person evolves, the less the need for stereotyped laws to control his behavior, because when he reaches a high enough position, he knows instinctively what he should do and what he should not do, and he doesn't need the services of lawmakers to tie him up in red tape and so ruin whatever it is he's trying to do. Question: does it become proportionally easier to evolve the higher the plane of evolvement? Well, that is relative, you know. You have to keep in mind that the higher you go, the greater the distance that you can fall. But I can only answer this question by returning to the classroom. If one has a child at school studying, then he is trained to study, trained to remember, trained to absorb information. If the child then leaves school and takes up some ordinary job, such as an office boy or something, then he lapses and he gets out of the habit of studying, so that if after a few years he has to study something, he finds the process remarkably difficult and painful. If a child is studying and continues to study up and up through high school, through university, perhaps onto medical or law school, then the child, now a young adult, is trained in studying, and he finds it easier and easier to study as he studies more and more. So you could say a person who is consciously, continually evolving and not backsliding can evolve more easily than those who are dragging their feet. But if the person does make a mistake and stops his own evolution, then he may go in reverse. He may go the wrong way and lose much of his evolution. So then he has to come back and relearn his lessons. By that time, he will find they are much harder. Question: do all human entities possess an astral body? Answer: oh, they definitely do. Everything does, not just humans, but all animals, even rocks. Everything vibrates. There is no such thing as a stationary object in existence. Such a thing is impossible. Every single article that there is anywhere is in a state of constant molecular motion. You might look at a mountain and think it's just a stupid lump of rock stuck in the middle of a landscape to prevent you from seeing what's on the other side. But it's not like that. It is a great mass of vibrating molecules, and the action of all these molecules vibrating together is to set up a form of electrical field which gives an astral body and also an aura. So the answer is yes, everything has an astral body and everything has an aura. Sometimes I get taken to task, although I must admit in the kindest ways, for apparently repeating myself. I'm told that I tell the same thing two or three times in two or three different ways, but then I get a letter from a person who tells me that he or she is very grateful that I have repeated myself, because at last I have got through and made a point. The first and second attempts at explaining weren't successful, but the third was. But now, another question. Would you please again explain how to control one's mind, how to direct thought. Now, I've already dealt with that quite a lot, but I've definitely been asked to repeat it. So, all you people who do not like repetition, read on, because you just might learn something. We have to remember that we are only 1/10 conscious, and the real source of knowledge, the real source of action, is the subconscious. But the subconscious is like a lazy old man who wants to sit and smoke a pipe all day long and not do anything. He knows he is the custodian of great knowledge, etc., but he does not want to part with any of it. He doesn't want to move, so you have to get through to him to galvanize him into action. If you want to direct thought or control your mind, then you have to know what you want, because it is useless to seek a thing unless you know what you are seeking. Otherwise, if you do not know what you are seeking, you won't know when you've found it, will you? Let us suppose you want to learn something. Well, you sit down somewhere where it's quiet and you think of the matter which you desire to study. Perhaps you're afraid your memory will fail you or something, but anyway, you think of the matter that you desire to study. Tell your subconscious what you want to do. Tell your subconscious why you want to do it. Say what benefits will be derived from learning such a matter. You have to get it over to your subconscious that you and George or Georgina are all part of the same firm. So what harms one harms the other. What benefits one benefits the other. So you have to think about the thing you want to do. You have to think about it directly. You have to think all around it. You have to think of all the advantages. Then you have actually to visualize yourself studying the subject or possessing the object. And if you make a real campaign about it, you know, do it perhaps 3 times in succession, the subconscious may be roused and will then help you to attain that which you desire. You have to go in for visualization. Now, visualization is not imagination. Imagination is something which can be indulged in on the imaginary basis only. No amount of imagination, for instance, would enable you to jump over a 30-story building. You might be able to do it in your imagination, and then you would be something like Buck Rogers, wouldn't you? But such a jump over a 30-story building is beyond the laws of physical nature, so it is imagination only. And many people waste time imagining that which is impossible. Visualization, on the contrary, is something which is entirely possible, because it is entirely in keeping with normal physical laws. As an illustration, suppose you want to buy a boat. Then, if you visualize yourself suddenly coming into possession of a large sum of money and going to the place where they sell boats, looking over them and finally deciding on such and such a boat, then you may find that your visualizations bear fruit. It is a fact that if the conditions are right, anything you visualize you can have in time. It may not be just at the moment you want it, but you will get it if you visualize things properly. You have to sit down comfortably. You have to cross your ankles and clasp your hands in front of you. Then you put out a very strong thought to your subconscious, calling him or her by the private name which I suggested earlier in the book. You tell your subconscious 3 times, "Attention, attention, attention." Then you say, "Look into my mind now." You repeat that 3 times, and then you think very definitely, very clearly on the matter for which you desire the cooperation of your subconscious. Let us get back to pendulums. You want your pendulum to tell you where such and such a thing is. So it might be a lump of gold, and in that case you will tune your pendulum for a lump of gold. Now, I told you how to do that in an earlier book. Then you will visualize yourself holding the pendulum by its cord and the swing indicating gold. You will pick up a map and you will try to locate gold through the use of the map. If you convey the idea with complete clarity and point out the advantages to the subconscious, then you'll be able to detect gold if there is any there. A question about the coming world leader. Will his life be made as miserable and as horrible as yours? Will humanity listen to him, or will they again just scoff and laugh, demand proof, and scream their nasty heads off? Will he be born in a country that is politically acceptable to the rest of the world? Or will he have to suffer from discrimination too? I will tell you this, that the world leader is not any of those overpublicized young people who are screaming around with much press publicity that they and only they can save the world. No, the real world leader is living privately, as yet unknown to the world. When the time comes, and then only, will he move into the limelight of unwanted publicity. Yes, he will have suffering. He will have misery. He will be disbelieved. He will be pilloried and persecuted by the press. But if his message gets over to even 1,000 people, he will not have been here in vain. At present, there is such a person on this earth. The body is being developed. At the appropriate time, transmigration will take place, and a greater entity will come down and carry on from that point. You get something the same in surgery or in art. You get a lesser skilled man to make the opening incision. Sorry, no pun intended. And then, when the basic work has been done, the master will take over and do that for which he has been acclaimed as a master. After the master has done the successful operation, some lesser surgeon, for instance, will stitch up and generally clean up the mess. It is the same thing with the leaders of the world who come here and take over a body which is already trained to operate on the earth. It would be such a waste if a great entity had to spend about 30 years kicking about on this crummy old earth of ours. That's why such people take over by transmigration. Okay, I have some questions here from a gentleman whose name is famous in connection with tea bags. He wants to know about longevity, and he asks, some people are under the impression that due to modern medical science, it is possible to live longer at the present time than, say, 200 years ago. Is the answer no, we can just get a maximum lifespan and it cannot be exceeded? But if we are foolish enough, it can be terminated prematurely? Could those early deaths in olden days be due to poverty and improper living conditions, etc.? Well now, actually, in theory, there is no limit to how long a person can live, because it all depends upon the memory stored within our brain cells. The memory which enables the body to reproduce identical parts. If we had a good enough memory, and a subconscious memory it is, a person could go on living almost indefinitely. Unfortunately, at the present stage of evolution, the memory decays. It's like the old army story. There was a long line of men, 100 men in a row. An officer at one end of the line whispered a message to the man nearest him and told him to whisper it to the next man, and so on and so on. And then the last man produced a message which had little bearing on the original subject. We get the same thing with humans. We can say that a patch of skin has worn out and the body entity wants a repair job done. But the memory is a bit sick of all these repetitions, so there is a slight divergence in the type, or the texture, or color of the skin. So the person might get one of those brown patches, which are a symptom of increasing age. Or a fastidious lady may get too much skin and find she's got a nasty wrinkle, and so she spreads a lot of goo on her face to try and shrink the skin. Eventually, there will come a time when people can live 500 or 600 years, and it will come about not through anything special in the way of surgery or medicine, but through a development in electrochemistry, because if we could get our chemical balance right, we could get our brain voltages correct, and in that case, cancer, schizophrenia, and other things would be cured. For example, a person gets overtired with too much work, so his body chemistry is depleted of those chemicals which build up the necessary voltages to keep him in operating condition. Now, if the person suddenly takes in some sugar, for example, and provided he's not a diabetic, he gets a sudden spurt of energy, and the tiredness goes away for a time. In other words, his battery has been recharged, and he functions again on the normal level. My old friend, Jim Dodd, who lives in America, has just sent me a copy of a newspaper cutting about electrical medicine. And Jim Dodd is highly interested in my comments because he's had a knock on the noggin through a car accident. And from what I can gather from his letter, the surgeons just about filleted him, but kept only the bones. An unfortunate state for a person to be in. Now, presumably, if he walks down the streets, the dogs come after him to take a chew at the bones. But there it is. It makes one think Isn't life wonderful? But this newspaper cutting about electrical medicine is only the stuff that I've been telling you about before, saying we seldom stop to think that our bodies run on electricity, but they do. And Jim Dodd wants to know if there's any truth in what the author of this article writes. The answer is yes. There's a lot of truth in it. But the sad thing about the whole affair is that medicine, generally, is at least 100 years behind the times. Orthodox doctors dare not risk their reputation in even attempting anything which has not been approved after 10 years' use by some of the trade unions that control doctors. Oh yes, let's bear in mind constantly that doctors have trade unions even more powerful than the Teamsters unions, and they are kept rigidly in line. Some of the medical members of the doctors' unions have nothing on Jimmy Hoffa for discipline, but that's taking us away from this stuff sent by Jim Dodd. Yes, one can do a tremendous amount with electricity. Electricity properly applied can speed healing, can the more easily unite broken bones. At the end of the scale, there is electrocution when a fellow is literally knocked out of his body and his astral goes wandering off. At the other end of the scale, people could even be helped to get born by electricity. Jim Dodd is particularly interested in electrical anesthesia, and the article which he sends seems to be very much out of date, or like a fat woman seen from the back, all behind, because electrical anesthesia is a definite, proven thing. Two electrodes are placed beside the head, and a mild current is switched on, a direct current, or DC current. And the patient, or victim, goes dreamlessly to sleep, because the astral says, in effect, "Gee, I don't like this, it's too hot for my feet, I'm going." And so the astral gets out of the body in a hurry, and doesn't return until the current is switched off. Actually, if a person knew how, he could put anyone to sleep without any difficulty at all. That's one of the dangers, because now, well, we all know the old story of the white slavers with their chloroform pad. They swipe someone across the face with this cloth soaked in chloroform, and the poor, innocent, defenseless girl goes to sleep instantly. But that is not so, you know. It takes a long time to put a person to sleep by that method. It's easier to use a coal hammer. Hey, though, don't go trying tricks with electricity or coal hammers, because it's very, very wrong indeed to commit suicide, just as wrong as it is to commit murder. So, when you read these electrical details, don't get crazy bees in your bonnet, because, I repeat, suicide's a very bad thing indeed to do. But if a person knows the very simple technique of electroanesthesia, just about anyone could be taken unawares and put to sleep. Possibly that is why doctors are so cautious about it. They probably want to have some rigmarole or ritual so that it appears to be more difficult than it is. What can be done is this. A patient let's imagine this, shall we, is wheeled in to the operating room annex. The anesthesiist puts just two little electrodes at carefully determined spots on each side of the head. The current is switched on, and the patient is asleep as quickly as switching off a light. No gasping, nothing of that kind at all. The patient is switched off when the current is switched on. Then, with the operation finished, the current is switched off, and the patient awakens instantly without any recollection of pain or anything else to do with the operation. And, interestingly enough, the painlessness effect lasts from 12 to 20 hours, during which time the patient is fully conscious and sweetly reasonable. That is, of course, if he was sweetly reasonable before. But this form of anesthetic will come into use eventually. It's just a matter of breaking down the bonds of prejudice and unadulterated fright. It is too much like electrocution, isn't it? To lie down and have someone put electrodes on your head and then switch on the current and bonk, you're out. Electric induction of anesthesia is a great blessing in operations to the liver, the kidneys, etc. In kidney operations, it's necessary to have a terrific amount of chemical or gaseous, same thing, anesthetic. But the poor, wretched kidneys which are being operated upon have to suffer the operation and also have the task of eliminating the chemicals used in the anesthetic, and that makes it very, very difficult. In electrical induction, there are no chemicals of any kind because, going back to our radio days, when the electric current flows through certain conduits of the brain, it just acts in the same way as the grid bias battery of the old radio receivers one used so many years ago. It sets up a back pressure of current, which prevented the flow of brain electricity, which meant that a person was conscious. And that's all there is to it. No pain, no suffering, no drugs, no chemicals, only sound sleep without any after effects. So there you are, friend Jim Dodd. When you read this, you will have your answer. It's a pity you couldn't have had this stuff when you had your operations, eh? Let us continue with some of our questions and answers which seem to interest an astonishingly large number of people. So here's a question about exorcism. The question is, a number of men of the cloth claim to have performed this operation, and some with great success. Others admit to poor results. Now, if they are not fully clairvoyant, and they are not, how will they know who or what they're dealing with? Is it permissible to state what actually takes place? Yes, it is. If a place is being haunted, then it means that there is some undesirable entity present. The entity emanates an unpleasant thought form or thought pattern. People become aware of the presence of such an entity without being able to say how they are aware. In some cases, they can see the entity. In other cases, they can feel the entity. But when they are completely non-clairvoyant, the person who is being haunted gets a great feeling of unease, strange impressions cross his mind, and even the least clairvoyant knows that there is something wrong. Those who can do exorcism are people with a strong thought wave. That is, they can project the thought of something very strongly. Now, a clergyman who has got himself thoroughly hypnotized in the belief that he's doing something as the Lord's right hand, and sometimes the left hand as well, gets his thought wave boosted up because of his self-induced hypnotism. He thinks he's the answer to the maiden's prayer, or possibly the answer to the Lord's prayer would be more suitable. But he is so sure of himself that he turns all the knobs on full in his thought processes, and the entity who is doing the haunting doesn't like that one bit. He thinks, in effect, "Oh, good gracious me, I can't stick to this fellow. If he's going to hang around like this, I am off." And so the haunting force takes off for pastures new, where there are no clergymen who are going to project unpleasant thoughts. And that's all there is to that. It's just a matter of telepathy, because no matter what anyone believes, every person is telepathic to a certain extent. It has been proved, for instance, that even when a non-telepath, self-proclaimed, was put to a test, when he thought at a non-telepathic victim, he could influence the pulse and the blood pressure of his test subject. That has actually been proved. Quite a lot of things have been proved about clairvoyance and telepathy, but they have not been made public because gory murders are much better selling attractions. Okay, here's a touch of humor. It's a paragraph from a letter to me. It is titled, ESP, A Further Illustration to the Accuracy of Your Writings Is This. A woman writes in our newspaper to say that she cannot get a night's sleep if the sheets or pillowcases have stripes on them. She can feel the stripes. It doesn't matter if the light is on or not. She doesn't have to see those stripes to know that they're there, and they disturb her sleep. Ooh, yes. That was quite a quotation, apparently from some English newspaper. I wish I knew which newspaper it was. Here's a question which could be interesting. The question is, would you explain the destiny of the evolution of plant and animal kingdoms? A lot of people believe that plants evolve into animals, and animals evolve into humans, but that is not so. You have never heard of a horse turning into a cow, have you? And you've never heard of a lettuce leaf turning into a bird. The animal kingdom, the human kingdom, and the vegetable kingdom are things completely apart. Things completely different, and I'm telling you in all seriousness, this is not a joke by any means, it's the absolute truth. On certain other planets, animals take the place of humans. On other planets, the vegetable kingdom reigns supreme. For example, there is a planet where plants such as trees are able to manage a slow mode of locomotion. They pick up their modified roots and move to a different location and sink their roots down again that they may absorb the necessary nourishment. So the evolution is this. A cabbage may not be very conscious on this earth from the human standpoint. But even so, cabbages can recognize people, and they can recognize emotions. Oh, you don't believe that? Well, that has already been proved. That has been proved in laboratory tests. So that, if your Auntie Macassar was a happy old soul, her cactus plant would be happy too, and would grow better and have a better color. While the plant of Melissa Mugwump, a sour old biddy, would also be affected and would have poor color and stunted growth. The moral in this seems to be, smile sweetly on your potatoes and they will grow better for you. Evolution is ever upwards, so the vegetables and plants with which we are today acquainted on this earth will in time become sentient, highly intelligent persons of the plant world in a different evolution, in a different incarnation. Animals also grow upwards in spiritual stature. It doesn't mean to say that your pet cat is suddenly going to start out and paint pictures better than Rembrandt, or suddenly start making radios on the kitchen table. No, their values are quite different. Their values consist of spiritual attainment, just as in the old days before the advent of communism and the television and press. In the far, far East, only things of the spirit mattered, things of purity, things of true religious thought. People earned enough money to keep them alive so they could progress through this earth and not have to come back to it. Humans, then, in far-off days, were better people than the humans of today, because nowadays humans are contaminated with TV, contaminated with the press, and contaminated with too many commercial interests. It doesn't matter nowadays in the West how good living a person is. All that matters is how big is his bank account. In that latter reading, I don't amount to anything at all, but I do know quite a few things about the spirit, and a person cannot take his bank account with him to the other side. My bank account is knowledge, knowledge which I can take with me when I go. Curiously enough, I've just got another question about that. Have minerals on any planets got intelligence? The answer is a definite yes. Now, I've already told you that on certain other planets the carbon molecule is not the building brick of that system. It may be a silicate, and there are stones of silicate composition who are actually thinking, moving entities. If you could go there and see them, though you can't, so don't bother your travel agent, you would have to stay a whole lifetime before you even saw a twitch of movement. Because if a creature can live for a million or 2 years, then the speed of locomotion doesn't matter greatly. So, moving stones take their time. They're about as slow as the people I had to move my stuff quite recently. Hey, do you know something? Now that I thought that I had finished dealing with transmigration, another question comes up. Here it is. It is said, the body changes molecule for molecule every 7 years. What Actually Happens. Certain Eastern books which give this information could be distorted in translation. This is for those who doubt changing of bodies. Well, let us give an imaginary case, shall we? Little Billy Smith can't get on with life. Everything goes wrong for him, and he's sick and tired of living on Earth, where everyone seems to be on his back. He contemplates suicide, which surely is a stupid thing to do, because if he commits suicide, he'll be slapped back to Earth in an even worse condition. But anyway, before he does knock himself off, he gets a message during his sleep. Tom Thomas, who is in the astral, wants to come back to Earth to do a special job, and Tom Thomas has arranged with a special counsel who controls such things that Billy Smith can part from his body provided he allows Tom Thomas to take over. So, Billy Smith doesn't think much at first of somebody else taking over his messy clay body, but as the days go by, the more he thinks about it, the more ready he becomes to agree. And so, a deal is made. Billy Smith lies down somewhere. The silver cord is parted, but before it can be completely severed, it is connected to a silver cord sprouted by Tom Thomas. And Tom Thomas, a gentleman of the astral, then enters the body of Billy Smith. Poor Tom shudders in dismay almost as soon as he gets there. The body is inefficient. The muscles are flabby, the feet don't go anywhere they're directed, and the eyes don't focus very well. In addition, there is a really awful stench from the body. Oh, never mind, Tom will get used to it in time, but he will find that the body isn't too satisfactory. He will be like a pilot in an airplane, a pilot who has flown aircraft before, but not this particular model. The pilot sits there, jittering with fright, while he looks at all the different dials and knobs, etc., and then, gingerly, he puts out his hand to get the machine working. Soon, he is able to control the body, but there is always this terrible feeling that one is in an alien body, and that becomes intolerable. So, the molecules of that borrowed body, that taken over body, are changed molecule by molecule, so that at the end of 7 years, the body of Billy Smith is no longer of the same composition. Everything has been changed, and now there is the body of Tom Thomas. And Tom Thomas is happy again, more or less, because he has the body to which he is accustomed. In the days of long ago, high priests were able to teach people how to do these things. It was much like going to a car showroom and having the head salesman there demonstrate new models. Bodies could be tried out to see which one was most suitable, and as I have said previously, in Atlantis and Lemuria, special no-ownership bodies were kept available for traveling gardeners of the earth. The bodies were used in much the same way as one rents a car, goes on a journey, and returns the car. Question. Yetis. Many claim to have seen them and photographed them in various parts of the world. Is this correct? Are the heads, hands, etc. on show in certain places, just manufactured objects to attract visitors? It is a strange thought, isn't it? People have gone to the moon. Robot ships have gone to Mars, and other robot ships are going to other worlds, and yet man has not yet thoroughly explored nor investigated all the aspects of this world. There are many parts of the Earth, in Canada, for instance, and Alaska, Tibet, India, and Africa, where humans have never been, and in those remote areas there are remnants of a race which should have expired centuries before. Yes, there are Yetis or Yetis. These people are the last dregs of a race which has left the earth except for them. Think of people trying to drain a lake of fish. For some reason, the people owning the lake want all the fish out of it, so it can be restocked with a different type. They use nets and all sorts of other devices to catch the fish and transport them elsewhere, and then the lake is restocked with a different species of fish. But from time to time, there are reports of one or two fish of the original type who have briefly been seen but not caught. You can't catch everything. A fish may be a pregnant fish. I believe the correct term for that is a twerp. It may be hidden in a small hole in a rock and so escape the nets, and when that fish shoots out her eggs or whatever she does, and the eggs hatch and then more fish are born, we get the same thing here on Earth in the remotest areas. But it's a good thing they are in remote areas, because there are so many bloodthirsty people who want to go out and shoot themselves a Yeti so that they can have his skin in front of the fireplace or something. As for many of the specimens, well, you can go to a waxwork museum and you can see some remarkable people there. But they are only wax figures, aren't they? I shouldn't believe too strongly in the claims that here at last is the body of a Yeti. Question: what are the pyramids? Where did they originate? How were they built? What is the real use of them? And will a pyramid-shaped object preserve things? Oh, and that is meant to be one question? It seems like a whole load of questions to me, but let us see what we can do about it. Pyramids are nothing but marker beacons. If you live near the sea or a river which is used by ships, you will see buoys in the water. If you live near an airport, you will see marker beacons to guide aircraft. A pyramid is that shape because that's the most enduring shape, and because it has four sides which can help reflect a signal. In the days when the gardeners of the earth came to this world, they came in spaceships, and the spaceships had to be guided in just the same way as a ship entering port has to be guided by the coloration and configuration of objects anchored in the water. When these pyramids were built, there were many other devices on the earth which now have been lost to man. Devices, for example, which could nullify the effects of gravity. Then one could put a sort of clamp on a huge block of stone and turn a switch and adjust a knob, and the block would rise up into the air, and it could be guided to its destination. This is not fiction. This is fact. Let me tell you something. In the USA, a special hotel was built. It was built first as a framework with a lot of pigeonholes, and then a powerful motor was fixed on the top of special boxes. Each box was a completely equipped room, and the motor was started, and rotor blades lifted the box up to the right height when it could be slid into one of these pigeonholes. I saw this, I think, in Practical Mechanics not too long ago. I wish I could have produced the picture for you. It was interesting. So the pyramids were built by anti-gravity machines. The Sphinx? You ask about that also. The Sphinx is a special marker device marking the locations of a great hoard of treasure hidden beneath. The treasure in this case is a museum of the arts and sciences of a long bygone age. That is the purpose of the Sphinx. Oh, in case you didn't know, there are quite a few pyramids throughout the world. Egypt does not have a monopoly on pyramids. There have been pyramids in Mexico and in Brazil, in certain parts of China, and in various other locations. And, I repeat, they were just marker beacons. Spaceships could home in on the signals emitted by these pyramids and then come in to the desired spaceport. That, I repeat most solemnly, is the absolute truth. It is not fiction. And here is a question which will interest many of you. The question is, where is the lower astral? What is it? The lower astral is a place or zone or time continuum where the vibrations are two-dimensional instead of three, where conditions are not harmonious. It is an astral zone where thought is not clear, where it is not possible to create artistically. It is what one might term a twilight zone. And just think of this. You're looking at a picture in the dusk and you cannot see the colors, can you? You may be able to determine the subject of the picture, but the dusk stops the colors, and you may see instead a more or less uniform set of grayish tones. You have to have daylight in order to see colors. In the same way, if one goes to the astral above this earth, one can see colors which are not visible on this earth. But if one goes to the lower astral, that is, if one is caught in this mesh of lower vibrations, one cannot even see the tawdry colors which one can see upon this earth. Chapter 10. "Oh, look at the old guy with the wheels," shrieked the young gentleman in the shopping center. "Gee," breathed his sleazy companion, "well, ain't that sharp?" Eyes darted right and left, gawking at any passing thing that caught their vapid attention. The two young men then slouched off. In the near distance, a slow-moving figure reluctantly detached himself from the self-imposed task of supporting a concrete pillar. Chewing hard, he lurched over, and with skill of long practice, he parked a wad of well-chewed gum on the side of the window of the nearest store. Hands hooked in his belt, he stood wide-legged and still chewed from long habit. "Say," he uttered eventually, "that sure is a mighty fine rig you got there. Steer it with your feet?" Not waiting for an answer, he deftly retrieved his parked gum and shoved that back in his mouth and wearily meandered off. "Oh, my God, look at that!" yelled a fat woman with inches of slip showing beneath her skirt. "Yeah, wonderful what they get up to, ain't it?" bellowed her companion. The old man in the chair snorted with disgust. An elderly lady standing in front gave a sudden start with fright at the sound, and just then there was a sudden lurch, and groceries cascaded all around. "You was going too fast again," shrilled the tattered woman. "Didn't see you at all, I didn't. You was going too fast." The old man, whose wheelchair had been quite stationary, moved off. "Oh," he muttered to himself, "let me get going and finish this book. Then perhaps we can look for a saner place than British Columbia." Another old man was dying. Lying on his bed in the darkened room, he watched with fast diminishing sight the gleam of light high up where the curtains did not completely obscure sunlight. A shaft of light struck across the room and made just a splotch on the dingy paint. The old man stirred restlessly, almost mindlessly. He was in no pain. Instead, there was a sensation of cold creeping upwards from his feet to his knees and higher. Dully, he wondered when the angels would gather about him. He had been an ardent believer in his religion all his life. He believed in angels. He believed that at his passing he would go to the pearly gates. He believed. The light faded as if a cloud had passed across the face of the man who was now feeling the cold. The cold as of ice creeping upwards past his hips, up to his waist. Slowly, slowly, it reached up towards his heart. Like a sunburst, light enveloped the room. He gazed about him with eyes which were fast going blind. Shadowy figures were about him, figures with wings. There was the rustling of voices, not understandable to him yet, because he was seeing as through a filmy gauze veil. The cold crept up and struck at his heart. With a last convulsive gasp, the old man started finally to die, as his heart stopped and his lungs ceased to pulse. Now, conditions were speeded up, because with the cessation of breathing, there was the termination of oxygen to the brain. The physical body twitched in the last nervous reactions, twitched without the old man feeling the twitches, without any pain. He was now beyond pain, beyond feeling in the body. The blind eyes, now dead eyes, stared upward, motionless. Within the body there was the rustling of fluids and the sighing of winds. There was crepitation as joints loosened, as muscles relaxed their tense grip on life. Slowly, a bluish-white mist emerged from the dead body and coalesced into an intangible form over the head. It became more distinct, firmer, in the shape of a nude human, an old, old man, racked with suffering. But as it coalesced and became firmer, the outlines became smoother, more youthful, more tranquil. Gradually, the connecting cord, the silver cord, thinned, frayed, and parted. The newly coalesced astral form hesitated a moment and then, gradually, with a slight jerk, started into motion, going faster and faster into an unknown plane. The old man in life had been a close follower of his religion. He hadn't believed in reincarnation. He had believed in the resurrection of the body at the Day of Judgment. He believed that all bodies, buried or burned, eventually were collected together and clothed again with flesh, even after 10,000 years. Now, in the astral form, he was lost, lost and wandering, a victim to the fallacious beliefs to which he had subscribed for so long. He believed in nothing but the dead resting in their lonely graves or collected in little piles of ashes from the crematoriums. But he was alive, alive in a different shape. About him he saw, alternately, black fog of nothingness, and then, when a little doubt about his religion came into his awareness, he saw another facet of his religion. Angels. Desperately, he fastened on to the idea of angels. Reluctantly, he threw aside the thought of resurrection. What was resurrection to him? He was alive, wasn't he? In a different state. But he could see angels, couldn't he? So what was this talk about resurrection? Let him live for the moment, he thought, and then he seemed to drop to the ground. His feet, astral feet, spirit feet, they felt very solid to him. The ground felt soft and springy and warm to his bare feet. But he dropped to the ground, and the veil was drawn aside. He looked about him. Angels were flying through the air. Cherubims were sitting on clouds. Great choirs were singing with monotonous repetition. Away in the distance he saw golden light. Away in the distance he saw the pearly gates. Swiftly he moved into action, running across the springy turf, inexorably drawing nearer to the pearly gates. At last, after an unspecified time, he reached those monumental edifices which towered so high above him. A gleaming figure outside, with a flashing sword of golden light, barred the way. "Who are you?" asked a voice. The old man gave his name. From just inside the gate, another sparkling figure opened a great book and, moistening his thumbs with his lips, rifled through the pages. "Oh, yes," said the second voice. "Yes, we expected you here. Enter." The great book of records was closed, the pearly gates were opened, and the old man, now a young naked man, entered. for some time, the newly arrived visitor was in a state of ecstasy at the realization of all that his religion had taught him. Angels, cherubims, seraphims, the heavenly host singing in a multi-layered choir, Saint Peter, the recording angel, the great book of all knowledge, wherein was kept the record of every soul upon earth, in which was recorded the good and the bad of every person who'd ever lived. Gradually, though, the old man, now the newest visitor, began to feel uneasy. There were inconsistencies. This was not real. This was pantomime. This was stage stuff. Where had he gone wrong? Was it something wrong with his religion? And then the thought came to him about resurrection. Well, he thought to himself, is this as ungenuine as resurrection? What about resurrection? How could dead bodies which had long rotted away be reassembled at the last trump of a great bugle? Where would all those people stand? How would they be clothed? How would they be fed? And this angelic host, this glimpse of heaven, disappointing place, I'm beginning to doubt my senses. No sooner had he said that to himself than there was a great clap, as of thunder, and the whole edifice fell around him with broken shards of the pearly gates and the golden light extinguished. But stop! A greater light came on. The old man, now a visitor, looked about him in awe. This was more like it. Running towards him, he saw people whom he had known in his last life on earth, people he had loved. He saw a beloved pet coming towards him and jumping up at him and shouting with delight. Another figure came towards him and said, "Ah, now you are released from your delusions. Now you have reached a true home, the land of the golden light. Here you will sojourn for a while you and you alone decide what you want to do." And so it is with many religions leading one astray. So it is that one can read of any religion and learn thereby. But the true wisdom comes in keeping an open mind, so that when the time comes for the transition from this life to another, you and you and you, everyone, can go to the state for which his or her evolution and attainment have fitted him. For in the greater plan of things, even those who have passed over to be protected from their own folly, if a person believes that he will go to an imaginary heaven, then it will be put on show for him until he sees the flaws. If a person thinks that he's going to a land of ineffable delights, where dancing girls are always there to entertain him, then he will have such things put on display for him until he outgrows such transient things. And if a woman's lib leader has her idea of heaven, a place where all men are slaves, then no doubt that also could be produced for her. And such plays can go on until the person concerned eventually comes to see the fallacy of such stage acts. until such time as the person concerned grows up spiritually and mentally and can accept the land of the golden light for what it is, a place of reality, a place different, yet not so different as that they so recently left. A place with the evil purged out. A place where one can only meet those who are compatible. A place where there is no hatred, no enmity, no poverty, no suffering. A place where one, in full awareness of one's acts, judges one's past endeavors and failings and decides what shall be done in the future. But the clack of the typewriter must cease. The platen must no longer be twirled, and the paper must not be fed in and pulled out. Typed, for the allotted span of this book has come to pass, and now it has to be sent to respected Agent Knight to pass on to the respected publisher. Miss Cleopatra Rampa sighed with relief as she turned to Teddy Rampa. "Oh, thank goodness," she said. "Now he's got rid of this stuff, perhaps he'll have time for us." It remains, then, to do only two more tasks. The first is to thank Mrs. Rampa for her constant vigilance in reading the typescript and checking slight errors. And secondly, one must really thank Mrs. Sheila Rouse, a loyal companion throughout the years, for the hard work she has done in typing all of this for us. End of chapter 10 and end of Candlelight.